Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Profoundly Pointless. My name is Nick VinZant. Coming up in this episode, mass extinctions and human touch.
Only about 5 or 10% of species survive, so that was really huge. And the mass extinction usually is so sudden and unpredictable. It's not something that has ever been experienced before, so there's no opportunity for a kind of learning or adaptation. It's amazing, you know, to go to Meishan or to go to locations in North America where you can put your finger on the end of the dinosaurs.
I want to thank you so much for joining us. If you get a chance, subscribe, leave us a rating or a review. We really appreciate it. Really helps us out. If you're a new listener, welcome to the show. If you're a longtime listener, thank you so much for all of your support. So I want to get right to our first guest because he studies mass extinctions, why they happen, when they happen, and why certain species survive. This is paleontologist Dr. Michael Benton. When we look at mass extinctions, like what qualifies something as a mass extinction?
I think it's important to realize that species don't live forever. So actually, each species lives for maybe a million years, and that includes humans, Homo sapiens, T-Rex. But a mass extinction means that there's a whole lot of species going right at the same time. And the most famous one, of course, was when all the dinosaurs disappeared, or should I say the final dinosaurs. I mean, dinosaurs had been on the Earth for 150 million years, so they weren't all living side by side. But a mass extinction is where there's an unusually large number of species disappearing at the same time. And not just one group like dinosaurs, but across everything, you know. So normally they're kind of ecologically broad, so marine creatures, creatures on land, plants, etc., etc.
Are we in one now?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think people commonly say yes if we allow that a mass extinction could last over a few hundred years, a few thousand years. You know, we need to scale what's happening at the present time back towards the past. But certainly some of the estimates would say we're pretty near it.
If we're in one, right? Like, I guess the question that would be then, like, okay, so if we're in one, it doesn't seem too bad.
Yeah, this is because we're each person is only aware of what's happening in their particular place. And many commentators like you and me, we're living in urban settings. And so the living creatures we see might be grass, and the tropics is where biodiversity is highest. And you know, the rainforests in Brazil, in Indonesia, the coral reefs in tropical areas, they're buzzing with life. You know, in one field of view, you're not just going to see five species. You know, I look out my window, I can't really see anything. I can see an oak tree and a bit of grass and people and a dog. So that's four species. But if I was to move to a tropical reef or the Brazilian rainforest, I could maybe see 100 species in one view. And then you see the sort of creeping threat of reduction of those forests or of the coral reefs. And you think, yeah, this is something's happening here.
My idea was kind of to run through the five big ones that have happened, but I'm going to absolutely butcher the names of them that I looked up. So feel free to be like, that's not even close, buddy. The Ordovician?
Ordovician, not bad, not bad. So, yeah, do you want to go through the big five and I can...
Yeah!
So, the way we talk about mass extinctions, paleontologists, the people who study fossils, have recognized that there were these events, and they're not in dispute. People accept these. But it's important to note that there were many other events. So the club, this top club of the Big Five, could be joined arguably by another four or five, according to different people. So the Ordovician was one that it was only observed in the oceans because there wasn't any life on land, really. There were big changes in the major beasts on the ocean floor, and it seems to be associated with a kind of freezing event. So this is over 400 million years ago. The next one was in the late Devonian, and there were definite extinctions that we would notice, like losses of armored fish. There were amazing fish in the earlier part of the Devonian, and they had heavy armor on the outside. There's nothing living really like them. And there were lots of changes of plants and so on land. And that seems to be, well, it was in two parts, but one of them seems to be associated with big volcanic eruptions. And then 250 million years ago was the really big one at the end of the Permian. And we identify it as really big because something like only about 5 or 10% of species survived. So that was really huge. All of the others, about 50% of species survived. But 5%, that's 1 in 20. And that's as near as, damn it, to, you know, complete extinction of everything. And that was the end of lots and lots of marine creatures that had been around for a long time. The corals, the reefs disappeared, and on land the forests disappeared. So it's not just that you're losing species, you're kind of losing a whole habitat, a whole system. And like on the Earth today, forests are really important as places for life, and in the oceans, of course, reefs are really important. So they went. And we can see the scale of it. Excuse me, because it took 10 million years for them to rebuild. And then at the end of the Triassic, 200 million years ago, there was a further extinction event that affected life in the oceans and on land. And sometimes you mark an extinction event by opportunity. And at this point, the dinosaurs took off. So the other groups had been wiped out. The dinosaurs were already there. They'd been doing quite well, but they'd not really taken over. Excuse me. And they took over completely. And then finally, at the end of the Cretaceous, the famous one that everybody knows about, 66 million years ago, disappearance of the dinosaurs, also the pterosaurs, the flying reptiles, the marine reptiles, things like plesiosaurs, also ammonites. If anybody is a fossil collector, the ammonites are these coiled fossils that are very common in the Jurassic and Cretaceous. They went, and lots of other things. And it's also marked by opportunity because the loss of the dinosaurs enabled the rise of the mammals, and the loss of various of these marine creatures enabled the rise of modern type sharks and various other things like that. And the main feature that marks them out is that life was disappearing in all habitats, you know, in the oceans and on land.
Do we kind of ultimately bounce back in the sense that, I'll just put easy numbers, right? Like, okay, we had 100 species before, we had a mass extinction, we come back to having 100 species again. Or have we like fundamentally lost something each time one of these happens?
The life bounces back. And I think the way to think about it is, if you think of an ecosystem, which is like the food web of who eats who and all the different species that are living together in some sort of relationship. If you delete species at different points, normally something of the structure remains and other species will evolve to do whatever it is. You know, if you kill off the animal that specializes in eating a particular kind of plant, something else will take it over and keep the overall shape of the ecosystem. So we normally find that the before and after numbers are about the same. Life will recover.
Is there something that you would say that they all had in common?
The ones that go extinct, people look for this because you would think that some you might think of a mass extinction as a kind of clear out of a, you know, like something in human history, that you have a massive catastrophe and all the old-fashioned stuff disappears and everything gets better. Normally, it's not like that because evolution is acting all the time. So species in the wild are acting on each other, and the competition for food or predator-prey relationships keep all the organisms, in a sense, on their toes. So they're evolving, they're responding to changing climates, blah, blah, blah. And the mass extinction usually is so sudden and unpredictable. It's not something that has ever been experienced before. So there's no opportunity for a kind of learning or adaptation, and it may be unexpected. So the comparison was, could it be that the weak organisms go and the strong creatures live? Actually, what seems to be happening is, it's more like what David Raup, a great evolutionist, said, was the field of bullets. And the analogy he gave was the First World War, where you have all these soldiers lined up in the trenches, and at the order, when the whistle is blown, they climb out of the trenches and run towards the enemy with their machine guns. Who gets killed? No way of knowing. Because, you know, even if you're strong and physically fit and you've had a good diet and you're highly intelligent, you're just as likely to be mown down as the guy down the row who is poorly fed, smokes like a chimney, is completely hopeless. And it seems to be more like that it's unlike normal natural selection. It's the field of bullets. Everything is equally at risk.
You just get lucky and
more or less, yes. And I think the features that make you lucky, I mean, there are a small number of things that are worth knowing. Number one, don't be too big, because big things need a load of food and they need a big area to forage and small population size. Number two, be worldwide, live everywhere. Because if you only live in one part of the world, there's less chance that some population might survive somewhere or other. And I guess number three is, have a fairly generalized diet. You know, don't be too fussy about your food.
I feel like we got those. I feel like we have those a little bit.
Humans tick a lot of the boxes, and there's lots of us. And so, but we're quite big in the normal run of things. Better to be cockroach sized.
Like, I mean, is this a controversial field in the sense that, like, there's disagreement about it? Or is this like, no, we got this buttoned up?
There's not disagreement about the events. I think people accept, you know, the evidence is so clear and overwhelming. And what do I mean by the evidence? There are many places in the world where there are rock successions, piles of rocks that span across these intervals of time. And the best section is in China at a location called Meishan, which is an old quarry. And all the way up to a certain point, the rock is just stuffed full of fossils. And then at a certain level, the rock color turns much more black. And that's a general indication of the level of oxygen going down, because there's a lot of organic stuff being black, which is not being eaten. Because normally any organic matter on the ocean floor is eaten by something. There's all kinds of creatures moving around. And if suddenly a lot of that is being preserved, that means loss of oxygen and no fossils. So you can actually put your finger on the point, and above the level, almost nothing. And you only find maybe one or two species. These are the survivors. And that's how we talk about this sort of loss of 90% or 95%. It's based on actual counting in actual locations.
On kind of a personal level, like when you see those sections, right? Like, what goes through your head when you see one of those?
It's amazing, you know, to go to Meishan or to go to locations in North America where you can put your finger on the end of the dinosaurs. Here we are in this location in Montana, Kansas, or whatever. This is the point at which the dinosaurs disappear. And that's what gets young people excited about a lot of this kind of paleontology and geology. It's not all theory. You can actually see it and put your finger on it.
Like, what would the world at kind of those times be like? Because if I'm imagining a mass extinction, like, I'm kind of imagining like a hellscape on Earth of, you know, disaster movies. But would it be so unrecognizable to us?
Probably not. I mean, because a lot of the action is happening in the atmosphere. So I think for the end of the dinosaurs, yes, we would have seen a lot of really shocking stuff. So I'll tell you what it was like. You're standing somewhere in North America or Europe or whatever, somewhere within reach of this. The impact happened in the Caribbean, on the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico. At that time, sea levels were much higher. And so this area was underwater. The meteorite hits, it was huge, it was many miles across, it penetrated deep into the Earth's crust, and then the equal and opposite reaction is an enormous volume, millions of tons of rock and dust come back up because they react to that huge impact. And the major pieces of rock would fall back all around the crater. Crater is something like, it's more than 100 miles across, 150 kilometers, something like that. So it is huge. And the crater is formed partly from the rock falling back, as well as from that excavation process. But a large amount of the material going up is dust. And that goes high in the atmosphere and resides there. It doesn't fall back immediately because it is dust. And that encircles the Earth. Something like half an inch thick of dust was in the upper atmosphere, which was enough to cut out the light of the sun. And so on the ground, anywhere in the world, you'd have felt that. You'd have seen the lack of sun, and you would have felt the cold. And then more immediately close to it, almost as from Mexico as far as the US-Canadian border, within minutes of the impact, within hours of the impact, I should say, there would be a puttering of small glass beads. The beads are just about a millimeter in size, so very tiny. You could see them, but they're at the limit, and they might be a little bit hot. By this point, they've flown about 2,000 or 3,000 kilometers from the impact site, so they're probably quite cool. And what they are is melt products. So the two things that happen when the meteorite hits are, I say meteorite, asteroid, they're the same thing, really, a big piece of rock. Yeah. When the asteroid hits, it creates high pressure and high temperature. And so there's a great deal of melting. So large blocks are not melted, they fall back. Smaller stuff can be melted and flung into the sky, and it falls within that radius into Brazil, up to the Canadian border, across just into Europe, but because the Atlantic was not as wide then as it is now. These are melted from the impact site. And so they don't have the chemistry of volcanic lava. They have the chemical components of limestone, essentially, which is weird. At the same time, a heat wave would radiate out from the crater in all dimensions. And this would be partly caused by the energy of the impact. And that would burn up the forests and burn up anything in its way. I don't know how far it would have gone. It wouldn't progress all around the world, but it might have progressed a few hundred or even 1,000 miles away from the crater. So there's an awful lot of physical stuff going on, you know, black sky, cold. If you're within reach of it, you'd be aware of the material falling back to Earth. But all around the world, even on the opposite side of the world, you know, in what is now China, what is now Australia, whatever, you'd be very aware of something very, very horrible, nasty going on. And creatures would be dying everywhere. A lot of it isn't instant. The plants may die because of cold. They'll die eventually because of the lack of daylight, but that would take a little bit longer.
And in some of the other ones that weren't maybe just because of that direct kind of immediate cause, would it have been really different?
Yeah, I think all the other events wouldn't have seemed so immediately, dramatically, amazingly apocalyptic. All the other ones that I mentioned are caused, it seems, by earthbound processes, not by some extraterrestrial thing. And most of them are explained by volcanic eruption. And so this has become clear in the last 10 or 20 years that And they're called hyperthermals, meaning very high temperature, because that's the key feature. I should have stressed that with the impact, you actually get cooling. So it's important to bear in mind that the end of the dinosaurs is associated with lowering temperature because of the blacking out of the sun. But when it's a volcanic-caused event, it's warming mainly. And this is because of the gases. So, of course, we think of volcanoes. You don't want to get too close to an erupting volcano because you'll get swept away in the molten lava. Well, yeah, of course. And with a big volcanic eruption, that would have a big effect. But not worldwide. The worldwide effects come from the gases that come out of the volcano. And there are multiple kinds of gases come out of all volcanoes. Some of them, like sulfur dioxide, has a quick effect. It has a cooling effect. But when sulfur dioxide mixes with water and oxygen in the atmosphere, it produces sulfuric acid, which isn't good. And it has a bad effect, not only in killing the trees, but it leaches away nutrients from the soil. And so that part of forests that are maybe affected by acid rain can stay blasted and bleak for centuries because it takes a long time for the soil to redevelop and acquire the minerals that are needed by the plants and so on. But when you have a volcanic eruption on a global scale, but let me reword that, when you have a huge volcanic eruption, that it can actually have effects over the whole of the Earth. And most of those effects are partly from the sulfur dioxide, but partly from the greenhouse gases. And there's a whole bunch of greenhouse gases that come out of volcanoes, particularly carbon dioxide, but also methane and water vapor. And all of these greenhouse gases have a warming effect. And although the sulfur dioxide has a cooling effect, it's fairly transient. That's quick. That's done. And the warming effects can last for much longer, not just a few days. They can last for months. So this is what is happening. The two things combined give you the killing effects of the hyperthermal, the heating. The warming is the key thing, coupled with acid rain. So this is what was happening at the end of the Permian and at the end of the Triassic and probably at the end of the Devonian, at least, those other big five. And the killing then on land is because the trees and other plants are killed by the acid rain. The warming has a huge effect because if you raise the temperature by 5 degrees, 10 degrees, life can't survive that. You know, we think that many plants and animals are happy at hot temperatures. Well, not really. Anything above 30 C is really not acceptable, 35. And so life will move. But then they get crowded because you're clearing out the very diverse tropics, which have much more life in them than any other part of the world. In the oceans, the main effect is from high temperature and acid. The acid will acidify the waters, and a lot of marine animals have shells that are made of calcium carbonate, so things like mollusks, shellfish, and even crabs and lobsters, their shell is made of calcium carbonate, and many others, and the acid will just eat away at that, and they can't really survive. So how long it would all take to kill, we don't know, but the nonetheless, the killing effects of huge volcanic eruptions are deadly, and they've happened many times.
How come it hasn't happened for so long, though? Or at least another big one. I mean, it seemed like it was kind of close together, and now it's been...
Well, not really. I mean, if the first one was, between 350 million years ago is the end of Devonian, 250, 266. So they're spaced apart by 50 or 100 million years. So another one could come along any time. People used to think there was a kind of regular pattern that we could say, oh, yeah, there's one of these every 30 million years. We can kind of predict, you know, the last one was whatever, 16 million, small one. The next one is going to be 9 million, 10 million years in the future. But I don't think there's a good evidence for a regular repeat.
Are you ready for some harder/listener-submitted questions?
Indeed. Yeah, I am.
Are you more surprised by life's fragility or ability to endure?
That's a fantastic question. And I don't know how to answer it, really. I think you can answer it both ways somehow. I think you can say, well, life is amazingly resilient, that, you know, many of the plants and animals we see around on Earth today have been on Earth for a very long time, hundreds, thousands of millions of years. And yet it just takes something like one of these volcanic eruptions on the scale I was mentioning, to have that devastating an effect. And of course, we can see the impacts of human activity showing how fragile nature can be. So, yeah, I can't really give a single straight answer to that, but it's a great question.
Domino or all at once? And I think what they mean by that is it usually kind of, okay, it affects this thing, and then that thing follows through, and then it creates all this, or is it like get everybody all at once?
I think the hyperthermals, the majority of mass extinctions, were domino, because I think that certain species would go quickly, the ones that were most affected in the part of the world that is most affected, which is a little what we see today, that around the equator, think of Africa, the Sahara Desert, because of global warming, the Sahara Desert is getting bigger, and therefore species that live in and around the desert are going to be hit first. And then I think consequences would flow out. And I think that's the same with most of the past extinctions. The only difference being the end Cretaceous, the impact, that was much more instantaneous, I think. That was like all done within a week, you know. It's not like all done within an hour, because the reverberations, the movement of dust and so on takes days, maybe a week.
Oh, it was that fast?
The dust in the upper atmosphere, that might have stuck around for months and kept the Earth black, but I think the worst of it would be over in a week.
Would we have survived any of them?
We might have done in certain parts of the world, but whether we're allowed our technology or not, if we had none of our technology, probably not.
Organism you miss the most, organism you miss the least. And I think what they mean by that in the sense is like, oh, we lost this, and this thing was really cool, versus, oh, we lost that, and that was probably really good for us.
That's a difficult one to answer, because I think everybody would have a different opinion. I love dinosaurs, so I'm very sorry we lost the dinosaurs. But then I don't want them back. You know, we've seen the Jurassic Park movies, and you think, why do they persist? You know, come on, this is the most stupid thing in the world. And having T-Rex wandering around would not be good, I don't think. What would one regard as a species we can do without? That's a terrible thing to have to even try to answer. I think most people would respond and say every species has equal value, even though we may not much like the mosquito or the rattlesnake. Nonetheless, you know, we would say they have a beauty, they have something about them. And many would say, let's wipe out all the rattlesnakes, it'll make people happy. But it's not for us to judge.
Do species ever go extinct just because they're dumb?
And I think... I suppose you could point to... There's something that we see we've seen in historical time, that when people first went to certain islands that had never had human beings on them before, a lot of the species, the animals, were naive. Not exactly dumb, but they were naive in the sense they didn't run away. They were just curious. And we've all read about or seen stories of, I don't know, penguins. You know, you go to Antarctica, the penguins are curious. They'll come up and have a look, even though you might shoot them. And in the early days, probably people did shoot them. And I hope nowadays people would not. But nonetheless, and I suppose the story of the dodo, people arrive on the island, they see this dumb-looking bird wandering about. It couldn't fly. It didn't need to. And it didn't need to run away because there were no predators until humans arrived. And then we go around hitting them on the head with sticks and shooting them. And you could say they're dumb. But they're just dumb because of our bad behavior. And presumably without us, they were doing just fine.
What animal of today, animal or organism today, do you think is going to be the best survivor?
I think I would just give the usual answer, which would be the cockroach. And the argument there is they can kind of live anywhere. They're all over the world. They've adapted to humans very well. That's why we see them so much. They're quite small. They're huge, you know, millions and millions of them. And I think they're kind of difficult to kill. If you've had cockroaches in your house, you can't stomp on them. They're quite thin and they seem to survive. You've got to make a special effort to kill them. So they would do well. Rats and mice, I think, would do very well because they kind of live everywhere. And all of those beasts, you know, they're willing to eat anything. They'll eat plants, they'll eat other animals, they'll eat decaying stuff. They'll eat paper. They seem to survive on almost anything.
Last one, kind of the big one, I guess. Do you think that we survive?
I think that most people are optimistic and would say that we will find a way. And it's easy to be loud and shouty about these topics, but it's better to reflect. And I think we can survive because we can, I hope, optimistically, that decision makers will accept that there are certain changes to human behavior that would be good for the earth and would slow down some of the changes that are happening. But of course, the other argument would be we have a certain amount of ingenuity, we have technology. So if Armageddon faces us, and we rather hope it does not, you know, that we can somehow find a better way to live in harmony with the wonders of the earth. But even if Armageddon hits us, we have technology. I'd be a little more cautious about that because, of course, people, it's easy for people who are not in the field to think, oh, yes, those science guys will invent something. And you've got to take a slightly more nuanced view and say, well, what is it you want them to invent? And is it really possible to do that? But yeah, there's ingenuity. But of course, I guess the thing is, how many people would be preserved? Would it just be the people with the money to buy the technology? I just don't know. But I suppose you can answer it both ways, and both of them are positive in their own way and would give you a little bit of hope.
I don't know if I have faith, but I do have hope.
Yes.
I guess that's the way that I would look at it.
We have to hope that humans are decent and that they will work together in a good way.
What are you studying now? What's kind of the focus of your research now?
I'm focusing very much on the end Permian mass extinction, but I'm very interested in the recovery of life. So how does life get back? And there's a lot of very good tools we have now for kind of modeling ecosystems and understanding how all that process of recovery happens and how the new groups fit into the system and kind of build a whole new world. So yeah, that's what we're looking at the moment.
When we get into that recovery, is it kind of nature goes wild in the sense that like some crazy organisms pop up, or do we kind of go back to the basics?
It's a bit of both. And there are certainly some crazy things going on. And we sometimes call these disaster species because they are the things that take advantage of tough conditions. And they may do well in times of perturbed environments, but eventually things do settle. And it may be a different cohort of species that come along and create that longer lasting ecosystem. And a good analogy is we can see it in nature today. If they're building a road, for example, you rip up everything and cut through the landscape, and then you can see the way life comes back on the margins of the road. And the first things to come back, there are certain kinds of herbs, plants that just grow very quickly. And you might get one species in Europe, it's rose bay willow herb, which is a kind of purple flower, and it just covers the bare soil very quickly. And it does fine for a year or so. And then bushes and small plants like that come back, and they gradually get better established. And eventually you get trees. So this is something that ecologists look at a lot, succession. And it may take 100 years for this disturbed landscape to recover. So that's a sort of concept within human lifetimes, within ecology. And I think it's something similar on the world scale, that you get this sort of opportunistic species that come in quickly. They're fine. They do well for a little while, but then they get supplanted and replaced, and you get the gradual buildup of the ecosystem, usually kind of starting at the bottom with various plants and bushes and eventually trees, and species animals come back in a similar sort of way when they get the opportunity.
That's pretty much all the questions that we have. What's kind of coming up next for you? I know you have a relatively new book out that covers a lot of these things.
I do. I was going to wave a copy, but I don't have a copy to hand. But it is called Extinction, How Life Finds a Way. So it's a bit about both sides, the sort of negativity, but also the positivity of how life can recover. And, you know, looking from the present viewpoint, the most obvious example was the end of the dinosaurs gave the opportunity for mammals. We are mammals, so we'd better celebrate that extinction event. Otherwise, we might not be here quite in the way we are. And looking back at older events, they triggered recoveries of life that built parts of the modern types of ecosystems we see today. So there's always been that bounce back, which is nice if we take a broad philosophical view. But taking a narrower view, survival of Homo sapiens, as we were discussing a moment or two ago, you can't be so sure about that. Of course, life will come back, but whether humans are part of that is up to us, really.
I want to thank Dr. Benton so much for joining us. If you want to connect with him, we have linked to him on our social media sites. We're Profoundly Pointless on TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube. And we've also included his information in the episode description. If you want to see more of this interview, the YouTube version of this episode will be live on March 28th at 12:30 p.m. Pacific. Okay, now let's bring in John Shull and get to the pointless part of the show. How long does it take you to get out of the car?
Probably less than 5 seconds.
Good. I also get out of the car very quickly, but I have noticed some people that seem to just be in there forever.
I mean, I'm already ready to go. I guess I kind of understand people who need to grab wallets or key fobs or something. But like, when I pull into a spot, I'm ready to go as soon as I shut off the car.
Do you ever just linger and sit in the car?
No. Actually, There are moments in my life where I don't even want to spend the time to get my kids unbuckled. I just want to go.
Yeah. I mean, I generally watch out for my children a little bit. Like, I'm not going to leave them in the car. But I'm still like, let's get out of here. Even if I have a bunch of stuff that I have to grab, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that it has never taken me, even as a parent with two children, it has never taken me more than 30 seconds to get out of the car.
It's taken me more than 30 seconds, but just because of the kids. But if I was by myself, I would never be more than 10 seconds, ever.
How do you feel about people who take a long time to get out of the car? Can I interject really quickly before you answer this question that I just asked you? I have a neighbor that I timed, single person, 1 minute and 9 seconds to get out of their car. I was like, what are you possibly doing? What are you possibly doing? And this was a person that was in their own driveway. 1 minute and 9 seconds. I was appalled.
I mean, to me, getting out isn't, I'm not more as concerned as with that as I am people who are, you know, ready to leave and they just sit there in the spot. That bothers me more.
Oh, but if you know that somebody is waiting for your spot, do you move faster or slower?
I get parking lot anxiety, so sometimes I won't even be buckled and I'll be out of the spot. I don't want to take up any more time. I don't want there to be a conflict.
I also move faster, but apparently there is some research that shows that most people move slower if they notice somebody is waiting for them. I'll move faster. I'm like, all right, you got to keep traffic moving, right? Like, I look at traffic as the greater good. Everybody's got to do their part. Get going.
Why did you ever have a solution for your neighbor? Did you ever figure out why?
No, they were just there. And that was after I started timing. I was watching them, like, they're still in the car. What are they doing in the car?
Would you say you're the watcher neighbor? Because you sound like one.
I am kind of. No, I'm aware of my surroundings because I work from home and my house is on a corner. And the house kind of sits up a little bit. So I have, like, great neighbor watching. I'm aware of the comings and goings in my neighborhood. I know when somebody new is in the neighborhood. I know when a car is parked in a place that usually is not. I'm aware of my surroundings.
You kind of sound like Paul Blart Mall Cop a little bit.
I've never seen that movie.
I mean, it doesn't surprise me. It's not a good movie, but it is a fun 90 minutes just to not think and laugh.
I mean, the name is the best part of that movie. Paul Blart. That was the... Well, once... after you heard the name of it, that movie sounded like it was probably all downhill from there. There was nothing funnier than his name of Paul Blart.
Well, and Kevin James at that point in his career, I mean, he was one of the hottest comedic actors there was. Kind of fallen off now, though.
Yeah, that's weird. I feel like comedians only have a certain stretch. I feel like there's a comedian that just blows up, and then they're gone. I polled the audience about our get out of the car question. Nobody is taking very long. Our entire audience is very fast. 67% said 5 to 10 seconds. 33% said less than 5 seconds. Nobody said 10 to 30, and nobody said more than 30 seconds. So if you're taking a long time to get out of the car, you are in an anomaly.
Like I said, I don't even think on accident I've stayed in the car longer than 10 seconds.
I don't know if I've ever agreed with you more. I have more respect for you about your decisions and getting out of cars right now. I'm like, yeah, John's got this. We don't
usually see eye to eye on much, so we should just count that as a win.
All right.
First time in almost 300 episodes.
This is a big deal. Like, I feel like we've never been in more agreement about getting out of the car. Get going in life. Get going.
Slam the door and don't look back. So many good analogies that can come from it, really.
Exactly. Right? I can't think of any more.
Turn off the ignition and just keep running. I don't know.
Yeah, you should have just left it at vague.
I should have stopped, yeah.
Right as you started to come up with something. That's what I tried. I went to the well, and the well was dry.
Yeah, not much.
There wasn't water in there for a long time either. Okay.
All right. Are we on to shout-outs? Is that what we're going to here?
Sure, yeah.
All right, let's start off with Sydney Mayer. I like a good Sydney. That's a cool name.
Boy or girl?
Male or female, actually. It's a female, and I don't know if they want their handle out there, but it's Sid the Kid, of all things.
Interesting. Women don't generally really abbreviate a lot of their handles.
Not really, no.
More of a guy thing. Okay.
Bree Wenzel, Renee Gandia, Carly Diane. Apparently a lot of the female gender listened to our last episode, which is a good thing. James Sagos, Sam Frenzy, Lindsay Roast, and her handle is Mama Lindsay Lou. So another kind of abbreviator there. A lot of those this time around. Heather Resig, Marco Christian, Sean Howard, and we're going to end with a pretty simple common name, Kimberly Marie. Appreciate all of you.
Kimberly Marie, I'm going to say is, I wonder if that's a full name. I don't think that you want that to be your full name. That's probably like a first name, middle name.
Yeah, I think so. Okay. All right.
Brilliant.
Got 10 bangers here for you. Ooh. Let's see. First thoughts, first things that come to your mind. Let's try to keep it moving today. We're going to start off here with P. Diddy.
Oh, what's going on with him?
Well,
that's like he's done something. I can't keep track with all of the scandals that are now happening involving certain people. Basically, if you're a famous person, you have probably done something terrible. There's not, like, we should just now have a list of famous people who have not done something terrible.
I guess long story short, from what we know, it's very early, but facts are that at least two of his homes, one in Florida and one in California, were raided by Homeland Security. And there's lots of different things going on, a lot of rumors. Don't know why they were raided, but I guess we'll find out in the next couple weeks. I mean, the consensus seems to be something to do with sex trafficking, but that's a pretty hefty claim just to throw out there if you don't know. So,
yeah, like once you start getting raided by agencies and not just the police, like you're in for something, right? Once it's not like the local law enforcement, they're like, oh, it's the DEA. Like, oh, you've done something.
Yeah, believe it or not, I don't think that's a very big list of people that get raided by the federal government.
Right. I don't think that, like, so. The federal government is raiding you. You're going to be answered. You need to retain a lawyer.
So the next two are movie topics.
Okay.
I'm going to start here with the new Ghostbusters.
Oh, I've lost track of how many times they've made 15 different Ghostbusters movies. I've lost track. Like, which one is this one now? Now they got the old cast. Didn't they have the old cast before? Once you've lost track, like, I'm out of all future Ghost movies. All of them. I don't, whatever happens, out of all of them.
I will say this, and I don't know why this is, but they made an, I don't know if you remember, they made an all-female cast of
Ghostbusters. But that was like three or four Ghostbusters ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, so it was before this, the Paul Rudd ones, I guess you could say, which are the current ones. And I don't know why that movie, no one liked it or saw it, but people are back on the Ghostbusters train now.
Oh, they like it, this one. Okay.
Yeah, good they're point. All about it. Actually, cool. I have a... Two more. Apparently, speaking of Adam Sandler, as we talked about earlier briefly, Happy Gilmore 2 is in the works. I don't think you need to make a sequel 40 years later to Happy Gilmore, but that's just me.
No, I don't like... Leave it alone. I guess you got, like, they got to do something. The only thing that bothers me about these kind of movies, I get the idea they got to do something. But, like, what ideas get put forward? Like, take some risks. Give us something new. It's just the old stuff all over again. Like, we just want something new.
Well, this isn't going to be new then for you. But apparently Michael Keaton, not apparently, this is happening. Michael Keaton and Winona are in the new Beetlejuice trailer, or our movie, I should say.
How many Beetlejuice movies were there originally? Was there one? Just one Beetlejuice?
I believe so. I there may be a two, but I don't think that's recognized officially. But for sure, there was just the original.
I'm okay with that the most.
Okay.
I'm okay with that the most. But just because, like, maybe they've got something new, as opposed to, like, something that's been going on and on and on, they're just going to do it again. I just want new movies, man. Give me something new.
All right. This one's a completely change of topic here, but say you're on a cruise ship in the middle of the ocean.
Okay.
And it starts on fire. Let's say a lightning strike hits a piece of the ship and starts on fire. Do you freak out? Do you stay calm? How do you handle it? How do you think you would handle that?
I'm going straight for the lifeboats. That's what I'm doing. I'm going right to where the lifeboats are, and I'm going immediately.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't think that's one of the things. Like, fire on a boat is not a good thing. Because if the boat catches on fire, where are you going?
Well, and I mean, that's a I mean, where do you go? I can only imagine looking up and seeing that and just being like, well, I'm dead. Doesn't matter. Game over.
I don't like modes of transportation with no way out. Like, where there's not really any options for you. Like, flying, I don't like flying, because if something goes wrong, like, there's only one way you're going. You're not going up. And, like, with the ocean, you're not, where are you going? I like options.
Just going down. Isn't it funny that you're either going down or up? There is no, like, in between.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's just, like...
Gravity.
That's just how it works, right? You're either going forward or backward. There's not, like, a lot of other options. It's just up or down.
All right, anyways.
There's no other options, man.
All right, let's see. Quiet on Set, the new documentary. Have you seen it?
No, that's one of those things that I keep hearing about it, and I don't really want to hear about that. I don't want to know is where my official position is with that. Obviously, that's terrible if these things happen to people. It sounds terrible. I don't want to know.
Well, if anyone doesn't know what it is, the brief one-liner is it's a documentary basically based upon the Nickelodeon shows of the early to mid-2000s, like the Drake and Josh and a couple other ones. And like the lead producer, was basically a terrible human being. He's in prison now, by the way. But anyways, it kind of people come out in terms of they, you know, like Drake from Drake and Josh comes out and talks about how he was kind of groomed and molested and things, and there's other actors, and you just kind of realize that these kids and their kids don't really have any control over any of it. And it's pretty scary, actually. It's a not a healthy way of doing things when you really think about it.
If the movie TV industry was to come forward and say, we are going to CGI or AI all childhood actors from now on, I would not care about the quality of it whatsoever. Like, that just doesn't seem like a thing that kids should really be doing. It doesn't really seem like something that works out very well for them. And if they were like, look, this is going to look terrible, but we're going to CGI all childhood actors. They're like, okay, cool. Sounds good.
I mean, we've kind of talked about it before about childhood actors. Most of them, unfortunately, don't go on to live very healthy lives. I mean, yeah, they might have money and fame, but they're not like happy.
Your whole perception of reality would be warped, I think. Oh, right?
It would, yeah, just be absolutely terrible. Well, so we've pretty much gone left, right, and center here. Shohei Ohtani and his interpreter stealing millions of dollars from him to pay off a gambling debt.
Oh, man, like, look, when the demon gets you, you got to do what you got to do. Yeah, that's like, hey, man, don't steal from people, right? Like, that's a crazy story.
It's, yeah, once again, if you aren't familiar with that whole thing, Shohei Ohtani is probably the biggest baseball player in America. Just Google him and it'll come up for you what's going on with him. Let's see here. March Madness. I got to bring up a local Michigan team.
Oh, God. Who is it now? Kind of the
Cinderella of the tournament, even though they got eliminated. But Oakland University took out Kentucky.
So wait a minute. They won one game and then they're Cinderella of the tournament.
So far, I mean, there will be somebody else, but I mean, there's okay. You have a college of 5,000 kids that took out Kentucky. I mean, that's a pretty big deal. Regardless, my question is to you. A kid that basically nobody knew had 30 points. They were off from three-point range, blah, 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 against Kentucky. My question to you is, within hours of him doing that and not having one ad, nothing, he had signed like 7 NIL deals.
Wow. Which
in college are, you're okay to do that, and that's how some of these athletes make money. But essentially, he made more money because of one game than he made his entire basketball career. It's nuts to me. It's insane.
Well, I mean, strike when the iron's hot, right? Like, if you get an opportunity, take it. Take it as far as you can possibly go. Good for him.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, I think you just have to be careful that, like, you don't know exactly what you're signing up for. But, like, go, yeah. Do it, man. I think the one thing about March Madness is it's a great example to me of what people can do if you just give them an opportunity.
All right. Ankle socks.
Our ankle socks, what's the point of having ankle socks when you can have no show? I'm not a fan of ankle socks. If you're going to wear socks that are going to be, there's no reason to wear ankle socks. Either hide the socks completely, get no show socks, or pull them up and get crew socks. There's no reason to have ankle. Why are you showing a little bit of sock? No reason for it.
I actually prefer it, but it's fine.
You prefer an ankle sock? You're like, oh no, I just want them to be down there a little bit. I want people to slightly see my socks. Either show it or don't.
Sometimes you're a grower, sometimes you're a shower. We don't know.
What does that have to do with socks?
Absolutely nothing.
Okay.
Final question here. Pant size. Are you the kind of person, are you gonna push it and get into pants that might be a little too tight, or are you just gonna go a waist size up and just be comfortable and deal with it?
All I want to do is be comfortable now at this point in my life. All I want to do is be comfortable, and there's nothing less comfortable to me than having clothing that doesn't fit around your waist. That's so uncomfortable. I don't care if I had to wear 50s.
Oh,
I would rather be comfortable.
Well, you're getting into my neck of the woods. You put on 50s.
I think jeans are one of the worst clothing things that we've ever invented. They're not comfortable to me at all. I don't understand why people like jeans at all. I think they're awful.
I mean, they're fine. I mean,
I would go dress pants before I would wear jeans.
Yeah, I mean, I do like a good dress pant, actually, and
Jeans are the least comfortable type of pants. Are they not? Are jeans not the least comfortable kind of pants that you can wear?
I'm going to say this just because I think it's evident, but I'm not sure you and I should be talking on pants because I feel like we only wear three types of pants.
I don't even know if there's... Well, there's sweatpants, track pants, jeans, and like dress pants.
Okay, so four kinds then.
Four kinds of pants. And I would make a strong argument that jeans are the least comfortable kind of pants that you can have.
Out of those, by far. Absolutely.
So why does everybody wear jeans? I think they're awful.
Because I think we've made it a cultural thing to where jeans are acceptable. I wish I could wear sweatpants to work every day. You know how comfortable I'd be?
I think that we should go back to comfort. I think we should all just be good. Like, if I had my ideal kind of dress, it would be Roman times type dress, where you're just basically walking around in a bathrobe. Like, the Romans had it right. And they, like, just minimize the amount of stuff that you have to be wearing. Whenever I see, like, historical things from, like, the Old West or stuff like that, that looks so awful that they had to wear all those clothing all the time. Oh, that'd be terrible. I wouldn't want to do that at all.
I was going to try to do a cowboy accent, but anyways,
I appreciate it.
Let's just move on.
Okay. Is that your whole thing?
That's it, man.
Okay. So our top five is top five places we don't like to be touched. Not sexual, just places I don't want to be touched. What's your number five?
I just want to put this out there that I'm going to sound like a real crazy person.
This is going to be enlightening about our real personalities. Let's hear it.
So here we go. So my number five is my stomach.
Oh, I don't want to be touched in my stomach at all. I agree with you. Wait a minute. Is it your stomach or the sides? Of your stomach? How do you feel about that?
It's the front of my stomach, pretty much around the belly button area. I don't want to be touched around there at all. I don't want to be... It's not even because like I'm a bigger person. I have nothing to do with that. Like I just don't want anyone to get near my belly button.
I don't want anyone touching my stomach either. It's not on my list, but I don't want anyone touching my stomach. My number five is feet. If that's your thing, that's your thing, that's fine. But I don't want to touch anybody's feet, and I don't want anybody touching my feet. I have no desire to have my feet touched or to touch feet.
I think that's actually kind of low. I have feet on my list, but it's a bit higher.
Oh, you have it higher. Okay, what's your number four?
So my number four are my ears. I do not like when people touch my ears, around my ears. I just don't like it. It doesn't feel good. It's just, I don't know. Like, there's no reason to invade my space and touch my ears. And I have these gigantic earlobe things. Like, you don't got to flick them. I get it. They're there.
Oh, I don't know if people have really ever touched my ears, but I don't want people touching my ears either. Like, don't touch my ears. My number four is your Achilles tendon. Like, have you, behind your heel, like, I don't want anybody touching that area behind my heel, like, right where your Achilles tendon is. Don't touch that.
Yeah, any
place a tendon is, I don't want you touching it. Don't touch it.
You want to be grossed out for 30 seconds?
Do I? Is it, like, how gross are we talking?
Not that gross.
Okay.
I was playing baseball, I was playing first base, and I had my foot on the bag, and a kid came running through and cleated my left Achilles to the point to where I had to go get stitches on my... I didn't tear my Achilles.
Oh.
It didn't sever the Achilles, but, like, I got cleated on my Achilles, and I'll never forget that sensation. It was one of the weirdest sensations I've ever felt.
I don't like anything with a tendon, like, no.
Yeah, that's...
I don't want anybody near that at all.
Ooh. Never forget that scene out of Hostel, but we'll move on.
I don't want to watch horror movies because of things like that. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
So my number three is, like, your pressure points.
Oh, yeah.
I don't like the people that come up and they're like, hey, let me feel your pressure point. And they, like, jab you in the throat or, like, stick their thumb in your armpit or, like... get you on the sides or something. I don't want to feel that.
No. Just, like, stay away from the vital parts of my body.
Yeah, like, let me deal with it. I'll be fine.
I didn't put it on my list, but I would put it on honorable mention, like my wrist. I don't like when people touch the underside of the wrist. That bothers me as well. Like, don't touch that.
All right, what's your number three?
Anything around my nipples? Stay away from my nipples. Like, not even my, I don't even want my wife really, like, touching in that area. You can go higher up on the chest, but don't go below the nipple or around the nipple. I don't want any touching there.
Yeah, so I'll come back to that one. My number two are feet.
Oh, you put it pretty high.
Yeah, once again, kind of like what you said it perfectly. Don't touch my feet. I don't want to touch your feet. If that's your thing, that's great. You know, I also am pretty ticklish. So even if I'm trying to get like a foot rub, I'm going to laugh half the time. It's not good. Not a good thing.
Have you had a foot rub?
In high school and college, but when like I tore like a ligament or tendons, but.
Oh, not, like a medical thing. Okay.
Yeah. Not like an actual like massage. I don't go get massages because I don't want people touching me.
My number two is the area right above your elbow. Like right around your elbow in there.
Like heading up towards your tricep?
Yeah, like right in there on your elbow. Yeah. I don't want anybody like that area. That's armpit.
That's one of those areas where if someone pinches you, you're going to just turn around and just elbow them right in the face.
I feel like anything on kind of the inside of your body, like, right? Okay, so I'm talking about, like, you look at your hand. I would consider that in the outside, and then your palm is, like, the inside. Any of the inside part of your body, I don't want people touching that.
Yeah, I don't. So far, you and I sound like we don't want to just be touched by anybody.
I don't really want to be touched by anybody, to be honest with you. Unless you're, like, my immediate family members and you want a hug, or you're my wife, like, I don't really want to be touched.
So my number one is basically my face.
Yeah.
My eyes, my nose. Like, I just don't want to be touched there. Like, I just don't want to be.
No, I would put my number one is also face, but I would go specifically my eye. Like, don't even put your finger near my eyes. I don't want anything to do with people putting their fingers by my eyes. Nope.
I'd probably go eyes and then my mouth, and specifically thinking of the dentist, because I just want to, like, run away from the dentist. I wish I didn't have to go.
No, I agree. I agree. What's in your honorable mention?
So I have the
whole body, basically?
Yeah, right? I have the chest, the nipples. I mean, I don't do that. That bothers me. I have my head, the top of my head. Mm. I don't like the top of my head, but that's more of, like, just a being weird thing. And then this one's kind of weird, but I don't like touching fingers.
Oh, like, yeah. I would agree with you.
Like, a good example is maybe I'm not touching, but like, say you're at a drive-thru and you go to like get something from the person giving you it, and you like have to touch their hand, or like, you know, they have to touch your hand. It's just, yeah, I don't do that.
Oh, I don't like a handshake when you get just like fingers. That's really weird to me. Yeah, I would agree. I don't want to touch people's fingers. I'm okay with the whole hand, but I don't want to just like catch fingers. That's kind of, a little strange. Yeah, I don't want to touch people's fingers. I have definitely like the top of my head, the hair, any kind of like the hair area. Like, I don't want you touching that. Behind the knee, that kind of creeps me out.
I'm good with that. Especially if you've had surgery done on your knees, I would say if you have surgery done on any part of your body, you don't want anyone to touch it ever.
I don't really have that much of a problem with my nose, though. Like, I don't really care if people touch my nose. I don't want people touching my nose if you happen to run into me, but like,
I would say I'm okay with people touching my back, maybe my butt, and like my shoulders. Those are probably the three areas I'm okay with.
I don't mind the shoulders. Shoulders are okay. I'm not too sensitive about my neck either. That doesn't bother me that much. I don't want the front, but if you're like the back of your neck or something like that, but that'd be kind of weird for another adult to come up to you and be like, hey, touching
come here.
Back here. Come here. Like your dad used to do, and they just grab you by the neck like that.
Like you're a dog and they just like pick you up. And
it's like, Dad, God.
Dad, let me go.
Yeah. The only other honorable mention I had would be like when somebody touches that, I think it's your sternum, like yep. that, the middle of your chest where that bone is right there. That's a very quick way to get in a fight. Like poke somebody in that and they're like, oh.
Yeah,
I feel like it's one of the laws of one of the commandments. Like, well, now we got to get in a fight. You got any other ones?
No.
Okay, that's going to go ahead and do it for this episode of Profoundly Pointless. I want to thank you so much for joining us. If you get a chance, leave us a quick review. We really appreciate it. It really helps us out. And let us know what you think are the worst places to be touched. Keep it PG. But for me, I don't want anyone touching my face. I don't really even want my wife touching my face, honestly. I don't even want to touch my own face.